Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Oh, it's Here and Now. Iraqis worked into the night as part of a last-ditch effort to produce a draft constitution by the end of the day today. Serious differences continue to divide Iraq's biggest constituencies, the Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds. The U.S. has been pushing Iraqis to finish today. But many in the country are concerned that a hastily assembled compromise might further inflame the insurgency and make it harder to achieve the Constitution's ultimate purpose, a stable, unified Iraq. The deadline has already been pushed back several hours. Earlier today, we spoke with Dan Murphy in Baghdad. He's a staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor. We asked him what was holding things up.
The things that have been holding us up all along, quite frankly, there is no consensus. There is no agreement. The Sunni minority, who, of course, members of the Sunni minority are the biggest part of the insurgency here, are essentially feeling railroaded by the now politically dominant Shiites and Kurds, who are sort of cutting a deal over how they're going to divide up power and influence in the new Iraq and aren't willing to play ball. They're unlikely to achieve that, although they continue to insist that they will finish this thing up this evening, Baghdad time. The sides seem as far apart as ever on some of the most fundamental questions about what the state is going to look like.
What are some of those?
There are two broad issues. One is the role of Islam in the state, and it is already manifestly clear that Islam is going to play a much bigger role in the governance and laws of Iraq than it has at any time in the past 100 years. However, the question is how much of a Shiite flavor will this be? The dominant Shiite majority would like senior Shiite clerics to have an advisory role on laws and in determining what is and is not permissible under Islam. They want language in the Constitution on this. This makes the Kurds, who tend to be, even though they're Muslims, they tend to be quite secular, nervous. And then we have the Sunnis, who are both uncomfortable with the notion of the Shiite clergy having an important role in the state, and who are also very worried about what we're calling federalism here, which is, in effect, the creation of semi-autonomous regions with a share of Iraq's oil revenue. The Kurds already have a de facto autonomous region, and they're looking to have that enshrined. The Shias are asking for a sort of autonomous Shiite region in the south, and these two regions, the Kurdish and the Shiite ones, are the oil-rich parts. And if this were to happen, the Sunnis would end up with very, very little. And they're terrified of essentially being left with the desert in the middle of the country and being impoverished.
Now, the U.S. has been pushing for some kind of a draft agreement, even if the Sunnis don't sign on. The Shiites have said that they want to hold off and make sure they have consensus. What would be the implications for the insurgency if a draft agreement came out without Sunni support?
It's already clear that any document they agree to in the next 24 hours is not going to have Sunni support. And remember, the whole reason that you want to have a constitution and build consensus is that you might start the beginning of constructing a new social compact that could get all Iraqis behind the experiment that's going on here. What it looks like is happening is that divisions are hardening. This process of negotiation has pushed the parties further apart and more into sort of strictly sectarian and ethnic thinking rather than national thinking. And, you know, if we alienate the Sunnis again, at best, it won't have any impact on the insurgency, which will continue at its current rate, and at worst could see it deepen and widen.
Once the parliament receives the draft, what happens next?
The parliament will receive the draft. They can vote on this by simple majority, and so the Kurds and the Shiites easily have enough votes between them if they want to do a deal and cut the Sunnis out. Then, by October 15th, it will be submitted to a national referendum. Now, in any three provinces, if two-thirds of the voters reject the Constitution, we essentially go back to square one. We have fresh elections, a new interim assembly, and they negotiate again. You know, and essentially this process was fruitless.
Dan, to what extent is the pressure that the U.S. is putting on the negotiators, does that work in any one faction's favor?
The short answer, I think, is yes. The Americans want a constitution now because they see sort of timetables and meeting timetables as tangible proof of progress, some of the only proof of progress they can show to the American people. But, the Sunnis did not vote at all, really, in the elections to this transitional assembly. They now realize this was a huge error. and future elections will certainly see narrower majorities for the Shiites and a less dominant position for the Kurds, who are sort of slotted into the number two seat right now. So those two groups are really served by Haste, and the Sunnis are really disserved by Haste because they are an incredibly weak position in the parliament that will only get stronger if there are fresh elections in the future.
Dan, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
We spoke with Dan Murphy of the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad earlier today. Today, Israeli settlers begin their historic withdrawal from 21 settlements in Gaza and 4 in the West Bank. Soldiers have started handing out eviction notices to 9,000 settlers, telling them they have to move or they'll be forcibly removed starting Wednesday. Tova Lazaroff is a reporter for the Jerusalem Post who's been living in Gaza for the last month, reporting on preparations for the withdrawal. She joins us on the phone now from Neve Dekalim, the largest of the Gaza settlements slated for withdrawal. Tova, tell us what's happening on the ground now.
I'm in Neve Dekalim, which is the kind of place where people, until very recently, would look at you as if you were crazy when you mentioned that this engagement might be happening. And today is probably one of the first days that there have been an overwhelming number of visible signs that, in fact, life here for this community has come to an end.
Tell us about the protest today.
Well, you know, people are very, one of the things that's happening here is kind of a change in population as, you know, the residents are moving out. Supporters from all over the country are coming in, people who believe that, you know, this area shouldn't be given up. And so they've made it past at least 4 army roadblocks and into the area. Of course, they did that before today. And they've been kind of camping out all over the place. And mostly, I would say, young adults, teens, and those young adults, you know, sat at the entryway to the community. It's like a, not quite like a driveway, but imagine like, you know, one street going up and one street going down and flowers and grass and trees in the middle. And they sat on the ground in front of both roads and sang songs. Some people prayed. And about 8 o'clock in the morning, the police came and they sort of stood there single file and both sides just kind of looked at each other.
Were there any, tell us about any other interactions that you saw. How are the police and the citizens interacting?
You know, in that particular instance, you know, it was sort of very, very calm, really. The police didn't really go much further than the gate, and the protesters stood behind the gate. There's a back entryway to the community where the army tried to come in through. There were some tough interactions there. In all cases, you know, not so much at the gate this morning, but it is often attempt by, you know, the settlers to try and talk the soldiers and the police out of doing this, out of a deep belief that, in fact, they don't really want to be doing this. And all that needs to happen here is for the settlers to remind them that they really don't want to be doing this. And then in a critical moment, they'll refuse to carry out the orders.
Well, on come Wednesday, I guess that will be the day we'll know for sure. Yeah. That's the day when they'll be forced out. What are the protesters saying about that day? What will happen then?
I imagine that they will, although they don't say it, I imagine they'll do more to try and block the road. But that being said, I think the plan of the residents here is to be in their houses.
Tova, thank you very much.
Okay.
Tova Lazaroff is a reporter with the Jerusalem Post. We continue our conversation about Israel's historic withdrawal from Gaza with Ambassador Dennis Ross. He was the special envoy to the Middle East for the Clinton administration, also served in the State Department under George H.W. Bush, and is author of The Missing Piece, the inside story of the fight for Middle East peace. Ambassador Ross, you've spent a lot of time trying to improve prospects for peace in that part of the world. How important is this particular moment?
Well, it is a historic moment, no matter how you slice it. The fact is, Israel is getting out after 38 years. They built up not only a settlement infrastructure, but a military infrastructure there. And they're leaving, and it creates an interesting opportunity for the Palestinians, because if the Palestinians can demonstrate to the Israeli public and to the world that they can govern themselves, they can fulfill their obligations, including the security obligations, they make a pretty good case for saying, look, here's a model that's working in Gaza. Why can't we apply it to the West Bank? And if they can't get their act together, if they don't overcome the factionalization that exists now, if they don't fulfill their responsibilities, it's pretty hard to then make the case that a model of chaos and violence is one that ought to be applied to the West Bank as well. So I think it is an opportunity. It's one where the Palestinians actually have a lot to gain, but they're going to have to take the steps to be able to do so.
Well, what's your best guess about their ability to do that at this point?
I think the ability is still limited, but I think the motivation is increasing. One of the very interesting things to note are some of the speeches that Abu Mazen has been making now in the last couple weeks, and they're very much geared towards establishing the need for Palestinians to prove to the world that they're up to being able to govern themselves, prove to the world that they can maintain calm for Palestinian reasons and out of Palestinian interests. Now, some of what he's saying, in fact, is being challenged by Hamas. He's said, for example, once the Israelis are out, there is no reason for any one other than the Palestinian Authority to be responsible for holding arms. And Hamas is declaring very strongly and repeating it that they're not going to give up their weapons, and they're also not going to give up resistance and violence, as they put it.
Of course, the argument has always been that it is precisely the Israeli occupation that gives strength and energy to the violent reaction. Absent that, perhaps there's a chance for a more peaceful solution and peaceful rule by the Palestinians?
Well, I think the justification for resistance after the Israelis are out really disappears. Now, the problem is Hamas wants to say, well, fine, but we're going to do it where they are. They're still in the West Bank, so we're going to resume it there. And you're not really going to be able to separate, because my concern is Sharon, especially at this point, under what is a direct challenge from the right, a direct challenge from Bibi Netanyahu, Sharon is going to want to show that he's not rewarding terror, he's not soft on violence. And if you see violence begin to erupt in the West Bank, you're going to see a very tough Israeli response there. And I'm afraid then you may see Hamas do things out of Gaza, given what the Israelis are doing in response in the West Bank.
Well,
so you can easily see a scenario that unravels fairly quickly unless a lot is done, in my mind, to raise the authority of Abu Mazen. Abu Mazen has to show his way works. He's got to show he's delivering. I think it's very important to be able to get significant assistance from the outside in the form of real labor-intensive projects underway immediately on the ground. There's a lot that has been pledged from the outside. Very little has materialized. Most of what's materialized from the outside in terms of assistance has gone to meet the recurrent costs of the Palestinian administration, not into labor-intensive projects that would put people back to work and demonstrate that something is changing on the ground. That's very important in the near term.
Well, I want to talk with you more about that and about the U.S. role and the role the U.S. might play in all of that, and also what's going on in Israel. We're speaking with Ambassador Dennis Ross, who served in the Clinton administration as special envoy to the Middle East. In a moment, what about the U.S. role in Gaza, and what does it mean for Hamas? What does it mean in Israel? More ahead with Dennis Ross. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. Today's show, It's Here and Now. Continuing our conversation about Israel's historic withdrawal from Gaza with Ambassador Dennis Ross, who served in the Clinton and H.W. Bush administrations. Ambassador Ross, we were talking before the break about the importance to the Palestinians now of demonstrating the ability to self-rule in the Gaza. What role do you see the U.S. playing in all of this?
Well, I think there's really two levels at which the U.S., or maybe three levels at which the U.S. needs to be playing a role. One is what I was just saying, that we really need to spearhead the international community's efforts to get assistance in on the ground. We've had, 8 months of pledges and very little delivery. So that has to change, number one. Number two, the key questions of security for access, which is going to be essential for the Palestinians being able to move goods and people into and out of Gaza, are not resolved yet between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Jim Wolfenson is working on a lot of these issues, but none of the core issues having to do with what the exact security arrangements are going to be, what role a third party might play in the crossing points of the passages or at the airport, what's going to happen in terms of practical links between Gaza and the West Bank, what kind of movement within the West Bank for commerce purposes related to Gaza is going to be permitted. None of that has worked out, even though the withdrawal, the disengagement is beginning now. So that has to be worked out by the time the Israelis actually do disengage. And I would actually like to see some of those arrangements even implemented in advance so you could iron out some of the kinks which inevitably are going to emerge, and when there's problems, would likely end up restricting the access. That's the second broad element. And the third element is what comes after the disengagement. Assuming it goes relatively smoothly, which I do assume, I think it's going to be relatively smooth. I think there's going to be some incidents, I think there's going to be some problems, but I think for the most part, it won't be characterized by a great deal of violence, either by settlers or by Palestinians. But I do think in the aftermath of the disengagement, there's going to be a very clear gap in expectations on the two sides. Ariel Sharon will say quite justifiably that Israel's just gone through an emotional trauma, because they will. This is going to be much more difficult emotionally and psychologically than most people from the outside fully appreciate. And he's going to say, you know, we need a pause. We need a pause to absorb what we've done, and we need a pause to see what the Palestinians are actually doing. And that pause, from his standpoint, is going to likely be one that he'd like to see last until next spring when the Israeli elections take place. Abu Mazen, for his part, even though he will focus on trying to make Gaza work, at least initially, he's pretty quickly going to focus on the next step, because he's going to say to preserve the calm, not just in Gaza but in the West Bank as well, he's also got to be showing that there's a political process that leads beyond Gaza and doesn't end with Gaza. So immediately you have, in the aftermath of a historic move, you have a gap in expectation. And that expectation will lead to stalemate, and that stalemate will lead to potential crisis. And it's better to anticipate that in advance. And I think the best way to do it, at least my prescription for it, has been have the administration do what it hasn't done up until now, which is to engage in what I call the grinding diplomacy of the Middle East. Take the roadmap where you have 52 paragraphs of obligations and where there isn't even one obligation that is understood the same way by the two sides, because it wasn't negotiated with them. It's time for the U.S. to sit with the two sides, take the time, take the trouble, and actually go through and make sure there's a common definition on every single obligation there. It will take some time, but it will also give each leader something to point to. In the case of Sharon, Sharon will be able to say that to his critics that he does know what comes next, and that is working out the terms of the roadmap in terms of its actual implementation. And Abu Mazen will be able to say the Americans have committed themselves to ensuring through this process that Gaza first will not be Gaza last. If we don't do that, you can see a stalemate coming even after a historic move.
Well, I'd like to see how this, how you think it plays out in Israel. Why do you suppose Ariel Sharon, you talked about the pressure that he's going to feel from the right, he's already feeling it. Why did he take this move now?
It's a very interesting question. I believe that he made it for several reasons, some of which are the ones that he's expressed publicly. Others are probably have not been expressed. Number one, the demographic reality is one that can't be ignored and can't be denied. And getting out of Gaza, where you have between 1.3 and 1.4 million Palestinians, is a way to reduce the demographic pressure. If Israel stayed where it was, within the next few years, there would be more Arabs than Jews between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. And that would mean that a minority was controlling a majority. That hasn't been the case up until now, but it would be the case. So I think, number one, getting out of Gaza buys 10 to 15 years in terms of the demographic problem that I mentioned. Number two, there was the reality that you had about 8,000 settlers living in the midst of 1.3 to 1.4 million Palestinians, and it really wasn't a sustainable proposition. And so I think his view was, and he said it publicly, we'll be more secure without having to defend small numbers of settlers there with large numbers of troops in the midst of Gaza. Number three, I think there was a political reality. When he made this decision, the fact is that he was under a lot of pressure within Israel because nothing seemed to be happening that was positive. You had four previous heads of Shin Bet, the kind of secret intelligence organization of Israel, come out and say that he was leading the country to the abyss because of the demographic issue, and he was doing nothing about it. There had been the Geneva Accords, which he had heavily criticized, and the Israeli public supported him that, but they were also saying, okay, it's fine for you to criticize it, but what's your policy? You have to have a policy of your own. So he took an initiative, and the initiative was this, and I think it was also informed by a sense that if he did this, it would take the pressure off of him internationally to take other moves, all of which I think is true, and all of which I think is even fair in terms of taking the pressure off of him. But I think the reality is this is what sort of governed his calculus and why he made a decision that no one predicted. I mean, one of the interesting things that I said to Palestinians, I've just spent a month out in the area, and they were questioning Sharon's motivations, and I basically said two things to them. Number one, you didn't predict that he would get out of Gaza, so don't be so certain that you know what he's going to do in the West Bank. Number two, regardless of what his motivations are, you now have an opportunity, and then you need to take advantage of it and focus on that and less on what his motivations are.
Ambassador, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Ambassador Dennis Ross was Special Envoy to the Middle East for the Clinton administration and Director of the State Department's Planning Office in the administration of the first George Bush. He's the author of The Missing Piece, the inside story of the fight for Middle East peace. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. It's here and now. Defense Department officials are predicting they will not meet their military recruitment goals this year. And against this backdrop, there's a growing number of people doing defense-related jobs in Iraq for so-called private security companies. The estimated 25,000 armed workers at these companies are neither trained by the U.S. military nor held accountable to the Pentagon. And yet they've taken part in some of the fiercest fighting in Iraq since the U.S.-led invasion began. Writer Daniel Bergner spent some time with private security workers in Baghdad and writes in this week's New York Times Sunday magazine about this growing and lucrative business in Iraq. He spoke with Here and Now's Deborah Becker, who asked him to describe what he witnessed at some of the private security companies.
It's interesting. The companies call themselves defensive and thereby justify the name private security companies, but they're very much performing a military role. They are really constantly embattled, and I use the word constantly, quite literally, being shot at, taking guerrilla actions, and defending themselves, shooting back.
And legally, what does it say about the use of these kinds of workers in military roles?
It's a great question and an unanswerable one so far. The military itself, the Pentagon, has taken a very hands-off, sort of cagey approach to these companies. In a sense, the invasion and the occupation has necessitated their role because there really aren't, by all accounts, enough foot soldiers in Iraq to do the job.
But the Pentagon doesn't acknowledge that.
The Pentagon doesn't fully acknowledge that, and it certainly doesn't take responsibility for these 25,000 well-armed men who are performing a military function there in Iraq. So we don't have a way to oversee these men. We don't really have a clear way to govern them or prosecute them should they commit offenses there in Iraq.
And the Pentagon is supposed to be drafting legislation to deal with this oversight of these workers, yes?
It is supposed to be. It's unclear. They've been quite delayed in getting that oversight proposal out. And, of course, it's very urgent that they do so. It's been about 9 months since they were ordered by Congress to come up with a plan. And it's very unclear, even if a plan is sort of printed out and distributed, who will really enforce these rules. When I spoke to people at DOD, they talked of Iraqi sovereignty as being the context. And in a sense, that's a kind of code for just allowing this military sector of 25,000 men to be governed by an Iraqi government that's so much in its infancy that it's really not capable of controlling the situation.
You say 25,000, but is it clear how many of these workers are in Iraq?
Nope, absolutely nothing about this is clear, and that's sort of one of the most stunning things about it. No real good track is being kept of these men, so the 25,000 is an estimate, as is the amount of money that we're spending to employ these men. The Government Accountability Office just issued a report to Congress taking an educated guess that about three-quarters of $1 billion had been spent up to the end of 2004, but the DOD just isn't keeping good track of the financial figures either.
But these workers, at least what you found out anyway about them, appear to be making quite a bit of money.
They're definitely making a good deal of money. Now, in fairness, I should say, I spent time with one company, Triple Canopy, which is among a few that really takes a serious approach to its work that is built out of former U.S. Special Forces, Special Operations soldiers, that goes about its work carefully and with a sense of patriotic duty. But nevertheless, the salaries are often three times what their counterparts in the military might make, about over $100,000 a year.
And I'm wondering, because of that salary, what does that do with other folks who are already in the military? Does it breed resentment among soldiers who are enlisted in the military right now?
There is a sense of resentment, and there's a sense that the military may lose its best-trained soldiers, its special operations soldiers that it would most like to keep, to these companies that desire them and are willing to pay very highly for them.
And you actually write about an instance where some of these workers were detained by Marines.
Right. Just a couple of months ago, 14 of these workers were detained by Marines, held for 3 days. According to those detained, that situation got pretty rough and involved taunting over the salaries. It's still a bit unclear how that one's going to unfold, but it's certainly an indication of the problems that might be just beneath the surface.
What about the risks for these private security workers? Do we know how many may have been killed in Iraq?
The risks are very high. I mean, and again, come back to that word constantly, they are being shot at as prime enemy targets in the eyes of the insurgency. So in answer to your question, again, the headline is we don't know exactly how many have been killed because there is no record keeping going on in a very reliable way, but the best guess is probably between 150, 160, and 200 of them have been killed so far, which puts the rate of death higher than it would be for, say, the British in the coalition or any other member of our coalition there.
You also mentioned this company, Triple Canopy, which was formed a relatively short time ago and now has contracts worth, what, some $250 million a year with the U.S. government. That success story, is that atypical, would you say? And is it because there is such a great demand for this in Iraq?
The quick turnaround of Triple Canopy from a couple of Special Forces friends becoming a $250 million a year company is somewhat atypical, but not at all completely so. I mean, the stories of guys going over there, setting up security outfits, and winning contracts very quickly, those stories are told fairly often. In one sense, it's a tribute to the ingenuity of these guys, but on the other hand, it gives you a good sense of the desperation that the U.S. military faced as they saw an insurgency mounting that we really just hadn't planned for, and a dearth of troops on the ground, and a desperate need to protect ourselves, protect U.S. officials. And I thought most strikingly, I had no idea when I went over there, there are actually private security teams protecting four U.S. generals right now in Iraq.
You mentioned patriotic duty. Many of us think that soldiers are over fighting overseas and risking their lives to defend their countries. Does it mean that many of these workers may not necessarily believe in what they're doing, and perhaps after this conflict ends, they could go to work for whatever dictator or insurgent leader has enough money to hire them?
It's a mixture. On the one hand, you do have people who are so well trained and so committed, in a sense, to their U.S. military past. For them, the answer is probably no. But on the other hand, among that 25,000, you've got to have many who are far less self-restrained. And the concern is that, yes, when the sort of boom market of Iraqi private security crashes, where are these men going to go find work? And are they going to go find work where the old-fashioned, more roguish mercenary once did, and that is sort of the forgotten corners of the earth, many countries in Africa, where in the past mercenaries have stirred up a lot of troubles.
Daniel Bergner is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. You're listening to Here and Now. A Michigan man is looking to divine intervention to help his state's devastated economy. Dr. Lanny Johnson, a retired orthopedic surgeon turned entrepreneur, says he's frustrated by what he calls the state's backwards business climate. So he's putting a prayer on four billboards along Michigan highways, asking God to help restore productivity and prosperity to the state. Mr. Johnson is on the phone with us from Michigan. Hello, and thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
What is the message on your billboards?
Well, it says, "Dear gracious Heavenly Father, forgive us our sin of being dependent upon the automotive industry and not on you. Please restore invention, productivity, and prosperity in Jesus' name, a Michigan citizen."
So why did you decide to do this?
For a number of years, Michigan has been dependent on the automotive industry, but it looks like it's failing. I was born in Highland Park, Michigan, which is not far from where Henry Ford's first plant was. There's no plant there. I lived in Lansing, Michigan, where R.E. Olds started Oldsmobile. There's no Oldsmobile. My parents and relatives all worked in Flint, Michigan, in what they call the shop, which would be Buick or AC spark plug. Vacant parking lots and where almost all those companies are now in Flint, Michigan. So it seemed to me that there are three aspects of life, mental, physical, and spiritual, and it looked like we'd exhausted the mental and physical aspects to no avail. So I thought, well, let's give a shot at the spiritual aspect.
What about your own experience in the business climate in Michigan? As we said, you are now an entrepreneur. Your company makes custom-made putters for golfers. How is the business climate, or how would you describe the business climate as a businessman?
Because I had worked in Carlsbad, California, to develop this company, which is the center of the golf industry, and I was having the putter club heads made in California and machined there, I thought, gee, you know, I think I'll bring the business back to Michigan. So I looked up, some places I could get milling done. I went to a place near Dexter, Michigan, and beautiful building, basically empty, machines everywhere, 10 employees, and the owner's storing vintage cars in the place. So I said, well, this is a good place. They look like they have good machines. So I got a bid from them. It was five times higher than what I can get it done in California. I went like, what's going on here? Well, they said, well, we used to have 97% automotive business, but now we only have 3. And I thought, well, maybe I'd get a good bid, not one five times higher. Well, then I went like, 30% office vacancies in around Michigan. And business offices, I'm going like, there's a real problem here.
Right. I've also read that the unemployment rate is skyrocketed in Michigan as well. I imagine it's taken a toll on folks, perhaps some of the business folks that you've just spoken about. But overall, folks in Michigan in general, what is it like? What are people feeling?
Well, I can tell you what's happened as a result of this is that I've gotten a ton of emails from small companies that are telling me how bad things are, not just me, but would you please do business with us.
Why do you think Michigan hasn't really been able to move on and away from its reliance on the automobile industry?
Well, I mean, it seems like it might be spiritual blindness since they did everything else they could possibly do, and it doesn't work out. And I think it was so good. And honestly, I'm not against automobiles. They're wonderful. They have been wonderful, but there must be some blindness because don't know how to do business any other way or with any other entity, or when that's gone, what do we do? Well, the thrust I made spiritually is, well, it mustn't be what the gift is. It must be we better go to the giver of the gift. And so that was why I put up that billboard. I'm not forming a committee. I'm not taking names. I'm not doing anything. That's the end.
All right. Well, Dr. Johnson, thanks for speaking with Here and Now.
You're welcome.
Dr. Lanny Johnson is a retired orthopedic surgeon and a businessman in Michigan. His prayer for God's help to rejuvenate Michigan's battered economy is on four billboards along the state's highways.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. In the world of PGA golf, Phil Mickelson delivered another one of his dramatic finishes. He won the PGA title and his second major golf championship in Springfield, New Jersey this morning. Mickelson birdied on the final hole, besting rivals Thomas Bjorn and Steve Elkinson. Last year, Mickelson pulled off another spectacular win when he sunk an 18-footer to win the Masters. Bad weather yesterday postponed the end of the tournament until today. It's the first Monday finish at the PGA Championship in 19 years. Well, Mickelson better watch out because golfers of the future are ready to take his place. Pro athletes are practicing their swings and kicks and passes and specialty sports camps this summer all around the country. According to mysummercamps.com, there's a camp for just about every sport, from archery to wrestling. Even a camp for professional sports broadcasters of the future. It's called the Scholastic Play-by-Play Network. Here and Now, Sean Cole recently sat in on the camp's first-ever session in Boston.
At the moment, when you tune into sports news in Boston,
Sports Radio WEEI, 2020 Sports Flash.
This is one of the voices you hear.
The Red Sox had last night off. They'll play Kansas City tonight at Fenway Park. Tim Wakefield.
But in 20 years, it's possible that you'll be hearing this voice, although it'll probably be a little bit lower.
The Red Sox are most likely to trade Kevin Millar or Mark Bellhorn because they have not been producing.
This is one of 73 campers at the Scholastic Play-by-Play Network's Boston Summer Session. One by one, they walk up to the front of a college basement lecture hall with no air conditioning and practice their reports. Their ages range from 9 to 18, all boys except for four, all white except for one. But what unites the campers is a borderline unnatural love of sports and the innate ability to say ESPN in that funny way.
I'm Guy Racky, ESPN.
Hold the camera, smile, hold the camera, smile. Good job. Let's do it one more time. Just go a little bit slower. That's an excellent report.
Jeremy Treatman is the owner of Scholastic Play-by-Play. When he's not coaching kids on their camera technique, he's promoting high school sporting events and calling games himself in Philadelphia, where his company's based. As a result, he's learned to talk really fast.
I got on TV for the first time when I was 28, and it was a fluke. I had already pretty much given up. So I thought if I tried, made a camp for kids and for people who really want to do this and who really want to try, that they should have 10,000 times the opportunities that I had getting in. Some of the things they do in the camp, we spend one day doing stand-ups on cameras.
Billy Wagner seems to be off the trade market. With the trade deadline coming soon, we'll see what happens. From Fenway Park, live, Dan Mayle, ESPN.
The kids also pretend that they're on this ESPN debate show called Pardon the Interruption, sort of the sports equivalent of Crossfire. One of the camp counselors gives them topics.
NFL sleeper teams.
Cincinnati Bengals.
Yeah,
they're not really sleepers.
They definitely. Are you kidding me? They have Chad Johnson, Carson Palmer. They just drafted Jason Pollock. How can you not like this team?
David Pollock.
We bring in a lot of speakers too. A lot of people in the industry for them to meet, and so they can ask the questions they need to ask from the people who have the jobs that they want to have down the line.
I wonder, is media now really more about politics than it was, say, 10 years ago?
Is media now more political than it was 10 years ago? I think everything is more political than it was 10 years ago, but
10 years ago, when the boy who asked this question was 2 years old. There's a real out-of-the-mouths-of-babes quality to a lot of the campers. Their knowledge of sports is extreme. Their fanaticism is more extreme. The kid who asked the political question has a sports blog that's so popular now, he's being followed around by the Today Show. There's a 9-year-old camper named Yoni Monat with the Red Sox logo painted on his yarmulke.
I said I don't want to be a player, so I want to be a broadcaster.
Why don't you want to be a player?
What if I get hit by a pitch?
Well, that's true, but I mean, you could get hit by a car. Life is uncertain.
Yeah, but at least there's a okay possibility.
The thing is, most of the kids do want to be professional players. They just know the odds are against it. Or like Miles Heger, who just turned 15, it's physically not an option.
I hurt my knee a few years ago, and I might need surgery, and I'm not a great athlete really anyway, so I said to myself, I have people skills, I can talk, I know the game. It's for me. It was calling me.
Well, if the kids admitted that, then I have to admit that, too. Of course, that's a big part of why a lot of people become sportscasters.
Again, Jeremy Treatman.
We all want to be athletes. We all want to be star baseball players. And unfortunately, we can't. We're not all Manny Ramirez. We're not the guys on the Sox. So if we're not them, let's announce them.
Plus, announcing the players, being on radio and TV, has a glitzy draw of its own. Caleb Seltzer, for example, a camper with the greatest radio name in the world, says he's been waiting half his life, so since he was seven, to join the ranks of his idols.
Like, just to hear Joe Castiglione's voice every night on the Red Sox, or Grandy on Celtics. Those are my idols, and I want to be the Joe Castiglione, the big man. You want to be the guy that's going to let everyone know what's going to happen, you know?
Caleb is in such a rush to get into the business that he's doing a week-long play-by-play of the play-by-play camp. He interviews other campers on a handheld tape recorder as the whole group heads to one very fortunate McDonald's for lunch.
How is this camp? It's the first time this camp has been in this area. What does this mean to you, knowing that this is your opportunity? All right, this is the first time that this camp has been in Boston. What does this mean to you?
Caleb continues with his interviews at the McDonald's. I continue with mine. A 16-year-old named Desmond Stewart sits by himself waiting for someone to put a burger in front of him. I ask him how often he thinks about sports, to which he responds, how often do men think about sex?
Every 14 seconds they think about sex. Every 13 seconds I think about sports, so, you know.
You're getting this dreamy look in your eyes.
It's the feeling that you get when you're, you know, playing the sport, watching the sport, reading about the sport, just studying it. And
talking about it?
Talking about it, especially. You know, I could sit there and talk sports with somebody all night.
And evidently, all day. This is probably the only camp where your mouth gets more exercise than the rest of you. At one point, the kids are told to watch a tape of this year's Super Bowl and call the plays into a microcassette recorder, which answers the age-old question, what is the sound of an insane number of sportscasters all doing play-by-play at the same time?
Goal 39. There we go.
Oh, it's batted down.
And that is batted down. It is incomplete.
Miles, they got to go long for Greg Lewis right here. They need a touchdown.
Throughout most of the Super Bowl exercise, Jeremy Treatman and Miles Heeger stand in the back of the room doing tag team commentary. And even though this game ended 6 months ago and everybody knows what's going to happen, the thrill of it, the reason they're all here in the first place, is the same. Or at least, it sounds that way.
Get ready, everybody.
Could this be a dynasty? McNabb, back, high, Lewis, touchdown! Greg Lewis, this game is four and they're right back in it. 1:48 left.
Our visit to the sports broadcaster's summer camp for kids was produced by Here and Now, Sean Cole. For more information, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, John Berger, Emiko Tamagawa, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Schugertz is our engineer. He's assisted by Vince Fairchild. Our web producers, Ken George, interns Kate Goldring and Noah Suskind. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Frank Stacio. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.